Welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a program dedicated to informing you about organizations that serve our community and how you can get involved with them. Here's your host, Chris Evans.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a pre-recorded production of Entercom Communications. My name is Chris Evans. This is episode number 10. We've reached double digits, Dr. Saria Sicosio. How about that?
I know, we're finally there.
So episode number 10 of the COVID Chronicles. My guest again today is Dr. Saria Sicosio, the Ambulatory Chief Medical Officer at Prisma Health. Thank you for being here again, Doctor. It's been a pleasure having you on the show so often.
Well, thank you so much, Chris, for the opportunity. It's been great to connect with our listeners.
And I'm glad to provide you the opportunity. We were talking before the show about reopening. That seems to be kind of the new mode that we're getting into now here in the Upstate and in South Carolina in general, and frankly, across the country. For a few weeks now, states variously have been reopening, lifting the restrictions that they had, the stay-at-home restrictions, the shutdown restrictions that they had for various businesses. And here in South Carolina, we're starting to do the same things. Let's talk about how we reopen safely and make sure that we don't see another spike, as has been predicted by some.
Yes, so we are still currently offering telehealth visits, and that is something that will continue past COVID-19. We have learned a tremendous amount from our patients and from our practices of how to offer the care most conveniently. At the same time, we recognize that there are some things that you need to come in and see your doctor for. Sometimes laying hands on the patient and examining the patient and looking eye to eye can be helpful. So we're approaching a new normal, Chris, and that's finding where is it appropriate to do in-person visits versus telehealth, and that new normal will help us guide the best care for our patients in a convenient way that hasn't been available to this extent.
You say the new normal, and a lot of times people will hear that phrase and kind of interpret it negatively, but the new normal doesn't necessarily have to be bad. I saw a report, I think just today as we're recording this, that Facebook is the newest tech giant to offer work from home to their employees indefinitely. Like if they just want to stay at home and work from home, they can do that. And the changes that we've seen come about, we talked about this when we first started this program, the COVID Chronicles. You and I talked about where this might be going and the things that we've had to do to adapt to the situation, like telehealth. That was, we've mentioned before, that was actually a phenomenon for a few years before coronavirus or COVID-19 was even heard of. And yet it's become, again, kind of a new normal, at least a much more popular option given the circumstances. And it's something that I think people will want to do more of even after we're able to go back to our lives in general the way that they were before.
Well, and I agree with you. And I do believe this starts to dramatically change the way we do life. If you're working from home, then it may not be as convenient to then get in your car and drive miles down the road to go to the doctor's office. What we may see is if you're working from home and you're taking a break between meetings, then you're dialing in for your telehealth visit. So again, having this opportunity and the way life looks, I think in so many ways is going to be better. There are so many good things that have come out of this opportunity to learn and grow and identify ways to continue to connect. And this is one of those ways that I see healthcare has changed for the good and for forever. It looks so very different going forward. And as we've heard from Seema Verma with Medicare, you can't put this genie back in the bottle, and that's not what patients want. People want access, and healthcare should not be any different. Just like you online order through Amazon, you should have the opportunity to online connect with your providers to maximize your health.
Hmm. Well, and there's a certain efficiency to it, too. You mentioned taking a break from your job to go and see your doctor. My wife was pregnant recently. We've had three kids over 4 years. And so she had a number of doctor visits that she had to go and make. And again, some of those doctor visits need to be done in person. You can't get an ultrasound over telemedicine. But if there's something that you can do, that you can just talk to a doctor over a brief, 15 or 20 minute period, and you don't have to leave the office for an hour, 2 hours, even 3 hours at a time, then you can get back to what you were doing at work that much faster.
Exactly. And let's say you happen to be on vacation. Connecting with your provider is so much easier now. Or if you have multiple visits because your blood pressure is out of control, instead of going into the office to get your blood pressure measured, why not take it from home and connect that way?
Yeah. And there's a difference also between needing to see a doctor and wanting to see your doctor. And if your doctor isn't one that is providing these telehealth services so far, maybe you could talk to them. Maybe you could address that with them and say, hey, this is really becoming a phenomenon. Is there an option that you have? There may even be an option that you're not aware of.
So true. And at the same time, I recognize being a family physician myself, there is no substitute for that relationship and connecting with your patient eye to eye. So again, finding that new normal in the combination of when does a telehealth visit work because it's convenient, and then there will be times where it's so important for you to come into the office and have a full examination so that we make sure we're not missing anything at the same time. Again, a new normal in a very positive way.
A few weeks ago, I talked with one of your colleagues, Dr. Carrie Cease, who is I'm going to get her title wrong, but she's a doctor of pediatrics there at Prisma Health. And we discussed people bringing their children in for well visits during the coronavirus epidemic that was going on. And that was something that Prisma in particular and presumably other health institutions in general had taken a number of steps to make sure that that was a safe thing. That you didn't have to worry about bringing your children in to get their wellness checkups, to get their vaccinations, things like that, because they're so important at that young age.
That's correct. At Prisma Health, we have taken extended measures to make sure it is safe to bring your children or as a patient to come to the office. We're practicing social distancing and also a universal masking process so that everyone is safe coming in to receive that care. Now, here's what we're concerned about. Across the country, what we're beginning to see is a significant number of children who have not received their vaccines because of this fear and wanting to make sure that the environment is safe. Well, we are approaching that point, and one of the adverse effects of COVID-19 is that resistance to coming into the office and now children potentially being exposed to other communicable diseases, viruses, and other conditions that put them at risk. So it is so very important if your child is due for a well child check to make sure they're connecting with the pediatrician and they can walk through the process and how safe it's become. We're thinking outside the box of all kinds of ways that we can also get those vaccines done to ensure that they get back on schedule. But this is, again, so very important. As we see daycares open back up, people will begin to take vacations and will be exposed to others. And for those reasons, we've got to get back on track and keep our children safe.
Well, and daycares are likely going to require those sorts of vaccinations anyway. It would be a shame if parents had kept their kids safe from the coronavirus for all this time and then they came down with chickenpox or the measles or something that we have vaccines to prevent. I have a friend here at the radio station who came down with a case of shingles. And I was like, man, that's terrible. All of the COVID-19 that's going on outside and you caught shingles. That's bad luck right there.
That's right. And a very real concern. And in fact, this has been discussed in the healthcare arena of the high risk for measles. When patients are not vaccinated, then we also see a reduction in our herd immunity or the community keeping these children safe. So measles is a risk for outbreak. There are other conditions that we're concerned about. And you mentioned chickenpox. That's also on the list. But several of those can be life-threatening and can cause some significant adverse consequences. So again, getting those children back in for well child checks and connecting with the parents is just so important at this point.
Well, and several of them are much more contagious than the coronavirus as well. I remember reading recently that measles in particular is very contagious. And so that's why it's such a blessing to have the vaccine for it, because it bolsters that herd immunity that you mentioned.
Exactly. Measles, in fact, is more infectious than the COVID-19 virus. So that is one of those we pay very close attention to. We've had outbreaks in our community in the past. And so it is on high alert for all of our pediatric providers.
And you mentioned chickenpox, too. I discussed chickenpox with Dr. Cease a few weeks ago, and she had mentioned that that's something that largely has been not extremely eradicated, but generally eradicated in children. I had chickenpox when I was a kid, and my sister had chickenpox when she was a kid. And it occurred to me during the conversation that that's not something you hear so much anymore about kids getting. I mean, they can still get it, especially if they haven't been vaccinated. But that's a recent example, so to speak, of vaccines really having an impact on preventing a disease.
Mm-hmm. So true. And something that we're seeing. I've recently read information about polio as well. Polio is a highly infectious condition that we were hoping to eradicate, but we have seen it pop up in other countries. And again, as we begin to travel, those are viruses and other conditions or diseases that we consider ourselves safe as Americans that will then again put us at risk if we don't get our immunization schedules back up to date.
If I remember correctly, polio, at least in the United States, was considered extinct for a while. Like, we had effectively eradicated it in the United States. Is that right?
That is correct. And we just didn't see it anymore because of vaccination rates. And now because we've seen immunization levels drop in certain areas in other countries, there is a risk for that exposure to come back to the U.S.
Speaking of how diseases spread and getting back to the coronavirus, COVID-19, I was looking at one of the CDC pages recently and noticed, and this has started to become news. The page, it looked like, had been updated back in April, but it seems like news agencies are just sort of getting on the bandwagon with this. I don't know if it wasn't heavily announced or if they just didn't think it was a story until now, but the gist of the page was how coronavirus spreads. And the point was that person-to-person contact is the most likely avenue for people to catch a coronavirus infection, as opposed to, as we thought early on when we, again, first started this program, the surfaces, you know, touching surfaces that had been infected and that the virus could live on surfaces for days even. That's not what they're thinking is the primary vector for getting a COVID-19 infection.
You are correct. It's not as often that we are seeing COVID-19 spread through high-touch surfaces, though still a possibility. Where we're most concerned are those respiratory droplets, when you're coughing, when you're sneezing. But we're also beginning to see on speech and when singing, these respiratory droplets not only can spread quite a distance, but they also linger in the air. So what we're learning more about in regard to COVID-19 and droplets is that you need space. And the longer you are in one space with a number of people, the greater your risk, even when people are wearing masks. So that's why the masks and social distancing is still very important. And as we continue to open up, this is a good thing. And there are so many people who are just ready to get back to that new normal. Let's just be safe and smart about it. Keeping social distancing, continuing to wear masks in public places where appropriate. This is these are important details and simple ones that we can follow.
Well, and it's interesting that you say that because on that page, there's no particular mention of masks. I thought it was interesting. They still mention the things like hand washing and social distancing, but they don't. Now, there are other pages, to be fair, that the CDC mentions wearing masks and even how to make your own mask at home. But I thought it conspicuously absent any advice regarding masks on that particular page.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. There is so much information that's available. And I think sometimes we're challenged with having all the pertinent information in one place. Of course, the CDC is still recommending when in public places to wear some type of face covering mask that covers both your nose and your mouth for the reason of the respiratory droplets and transmission.
You know, the amount of information is kind of staggering as we learn more and more about the disease. And we've even seen a fair amount of misinformation regarding how the virus spreads or what can kill it, things like that. I was thinking about this week. You sent me an article, and the content of the article is not really the point of the question here, but you had sent me an article that you thought, in your capacity as a doctor and a researcher of COVID-19, was an interesting point and had some interesting information in it. There was a listener to one of our sister stations that actually sent us the same article, except his interpretation of it was that it was largely speculative and not necessarily to be taken seriously. And I thought it was interesting that two very smart people, he had a set of credentials that I'm not going to call into question here. I'm willing to take his word for it. But two very smart people would come to different conclusions about the same article. And without choosing sides or really getting into the article itself, I wonder how do you, Dr. Saria Sicosio, discern between sources of conflicting information?
So that's an excellent comment, and I think one that deserves further discussion. We are all seeing the same information, and we continue to interpret it differently. So it doesn't mean that one way is right and one way is wrong, to your point that you were making, Chris, but it's being aware that this information is out there. And what I tend to do is watch for information, read the materials very carefully, and then see how often it's validated or repeated. So it gives us something to think about, and helps us as we develop a research base of what is true and what is myth and what has been proven to not be true. It gives us a place to start and to have an open mind of what this data is trying to tell us.
One of the other things that I noticed while I was perusing the CDC pages is the I was trying to find information about the course of the disease and really how long it takes for people to get over a COVID-19 infection. We talked early on about the asymptomatic cases that were a concern. As you mentioned just a few minutes ago, the social distancing and wearing masks and things like that are still important, because we've seen asymptomatic cases that have led to, you know, other infections, and some people develop symptoms and some people don't. Do we have any more information about why some people develop symptoms and some people don't?
Yes, we certainly have more information available to us. At the same time, it's not necessarily helping us to determine the risk of one individual and why they may have the virus longer and others may recover quickly. And in fact, we've seen cases now where people remain positive for weeks on end. And just being positive from a test perspective does not necessarily mean that you are shedding the virus or that you are infectious to others. But with the data we have so far, we just can't tell the difference. And I think that's an excellent opportunity to discuss antibody testing. We're seeing that there are some individuals who had a positive COVID-19 test and had experienced symptoms, and their antibody test is negative. So what does that tell us? Mm. Does that tell us they never produced antibodies? Does that tell us that those who do produce the antibodies are safe? And that's just not been validated. And we've seen people who have had the antibodies who then are either reinfected or relapse. So we are still in this state of fog, if you will, lots of information to digest without a direction or predictability of how people will respond and recover.
Part of the question was, have we gotten any better? I've heard the statistic that roughly 80% of the cases of COVID-19 will be mild cases, as opposed to on the order of 20% that will be severe and may necessitate hospitalization. But I'm wondering if we've gotten any better at identifying those. Obviously, are the cases with symptoms. I mean, people who actually present with the disease, because we're, as far as I know, we're not testing people who don't have any symptoms, right?
Actually, we are.
Oh, are we now? Okay.
Yes, once we began our community testing across South Carolina, and this was at the direction of Governor McMaster, we are testing individuals who have symptoms and those who show up to the community testing site out of curiosity.
Okay, well, that's good. So I guess the question is, have we gotten any better at identifying positive cases, people who actually have COVID-19 but aren't showing symptoms, or maybe showing subtle symptoms that we wouldn't have caught before?
Unfortunately, no.
No. Okay.
There's more information available. However, we still see that 44% of cases of COVID-19 are coming from asymptomatic carriers, so people who are asymptomatic, and we can't tell who they are until they've been tested.
How likely is it that other diseases have this same sort of lack of symptoms? Like when people get the flu, are there flu cases that people don't exhibit any symptoms, but they have a flu infection?
Yes, we do see that, and we also see it with conditions like strep throat. You can have a carrier that exposes others but never expresses symptoms themselves. So this is common with viral infections, bacterial infections, and we're just more attuned to it right now because of the risk of COVID-19. But this is similarly expressed with other diseases.
Well, and we touched on how long somebody may suffer from the symptoms of a COVID-19 infection. The statistics that I saw, or the numbers, I should say, that I saw on the CDC website were a little, they were confusing to me, because as far as I could tell, people who had mild infections would generally get over it in about 2 weeks. I think they were saying 10 to 14 days. but people who had more severe infections, it lasted longer, and people who actually died from the infections were the longest still. That seemed kind of counterintuitive to me. If somebody was frail enough or susceptible enough to die from coronavirus, wouldn't it happen quickly as opposed to taking a very long time? Does that make sense?
That makes sense as a possibility. And then, of course, COVID-19 is certainly taking its own course.
Well,
and
that's fair.
For some, it will happen quickly. And for others, it is deterioration of the body and the inflammatory response that challenges the survival of some of these individuals. Another interesting fact that I've read recently is there is no correlation between the severity of the illness in an individual and their viral particle counts. There's no connection there. It's more of a positive or a negative, and who knows how you will respond at this point. Now, I've also read a recent twin study for COVID-19, and what it has begun to indicate is that your genetic material or your DNA may indicate how you respond or what type of symptoms that you have with COVID-19. So, for example, one set of twins may both present the same with the fever and the sore throat, yet another set of twins may present similarly where they have that loss of taste or smell.
Fascinating. One final point that I wanted to make, and we've talked about this before, but it's been a while, so I think it bears repeating. This week, President Trump announced that he's taking hydroxychloroquine. And usually the advice that you get when you get a cold or you get the flu is not to take an antibiotic because it's a viral infection and the antibiotics work on bacterial infections and they're not going to do you any good. It's wasted medicine effectively. On the other hand, there are any number of medicines that have what are called off-label uses, uses that they were not originally intended for, that are effective in treating a variety of conditions. What have we learned about hydroxychloroquine and its effectiveness against COVID-19?
There has definitely been a whole lot of commentary about hydroxychloroquine since our president's comments about his personal usage of chloroquine. Here's what we know. The evidence at this point, now that many patients have been exposed and treated with chloroquine, is we're not seeing the same optimism or the impact on the disease that we thought we saw with very small groups of patients in trials. And many people have talked about the potential side effects of chloroquine. Yes, we use this drug for individuals that have been suffering with lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, which are autoimmune disease. And so the thought was, because this is an autoimmune disease where you're attacking your own system, and we know that with COVID-19, you have an overly responsive inflammatory response, that for those reasons that we may see a connection.
I see.
Well, we're just not seeing that prove out. And then here's another important point. It's been brought up about the cardiac disturbances or the potential impact that chloroquine has on your heart rhythm. And yes, these drugs have been used in other patient populations and watched very carefully. This is a potential side effect. So some may say, well, that side effect has been there forever and we still keep using the medication. That's correct. However, with growing the population of patients that you're exposing to this medication, the more likely you are to have fatal effects with cardiac outcomes. So I think that's really important. So it's not that it's not a drug that doesn't work for other diseases or conditions, but we haven't seen the evidence that it is actually helping the COVID-19 disease. It's definitely not preventing COVID-19 either. And the more people who try to use this, the greater likelihood we will see more fatal or life-threatening cardiac arrhythmias.
Well, and presumably with hydroxychloroquine and using it to treat other diseases or any drug to treat other diseases, the decision has been made between the doctor and the patient that the side effects are worth the risk of treating the disease as long as the medicine actually treats the disease.
That's right, because every medication as we know it has a potential for side effects, even Tylenol or other over-the-counter medications. So every medication has its risks and something that is important that you discuss with your provider.
Before we finish, remdesivir is another drug that's come up in the news as a potential treatment for COVID-19. And South Carolina, SEDHEC, has just announced that they have received a donation of doses of this drug. Do you know whether Prisma is going to be getting any of that? Or do you know how that's going to be distributed by DHEC?
Yes, in fact, we are actively participating in those clinical research trials that are occurring across the country. We've received some of those allocation medication supplies from DHEC. And so for the right patient, this medication can be helpful. However, there's several indications of why it's not used. One of those is if the kidneys are affected, it can actually be dangerous to the patient. So there are several stipulations where it may not be indicated. So we certainly don't use it on every COVID-19 patient, but when the patient fits the criteria that's recommended by the drug company and the FDA, then we are certainly participating in that trial.
Dr. Saria Sicosio, a pleasure as always to speak to you, Ambulatory Chief Medical Officer at Prisma Health. Thank you for being on the show again.
And my pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
I'm Chris Evans, and this has been Focus on the Upstate.
You've been listening to Focus on the Upstate with Chris Evans. If you would like more information on today's topic, email Chris at cevans@intercom.com.